and all this other sort of support was. You see that even these days, that when I was a young monk, wearing the brown robes was a bit sort of uncommon. These are this colour brown robes. Most of the monks in the cities, they wore the bright yellow robes. And people always said that the reason they wore the really bright, almost fluorescent robes you saw in Bangkok was to make it safer to cross the busy roads. It was like fluorescent. But later on, when the brown forest robes became, the forest monks became more popular, these became more popular. So people would actually wear even these brown robes of a forest monk, even though they lived in the city. And just because, you know, to get more support. So, you know, sometimes that people do these things, and just to get material well-being, rather than for the real purpose, which is the spiritual freedoms. So, you know, that's what Susima did. And also, just to make the point that, you know, that Ananda gave him the novice ordination, which is called the going forth. And it was the Buddha himself who gave Susima the higher ordination. So Susima was going in there to find out why Buddhism was getting so popular. And in those days, I thought, just get the teachings. You get the teachings and then learn them, and then you can recite them to others. And I must admit that, just some of the stories. It's nice to have a few anecdotes of this to fill it out and make it come alive, these teachings. There was a young man came to ordain at Bodhinyana Monastery. He was an Anagarika, he was in the Anagarika block. And then he started describing to one of the other senior monks, you know, whose name won't be mentioned, but, you know, was in Thailand and... but anyway, I think you might know him. But anyway, that, you know, he was telling him, he said, oh, this Anagarika, he's actually just getting these incredible deep states. He's meditating all afternoon. And, you know, he just started describing, you know, all these incredible states of meditation. And this monk said, just like you described them in the book. And he says, you know, that's what he's getting. And then, you know, I was a bit sort of concerned that, you know, he didn't seem the right type, but who knows? So he's getting all these great states, and then one day, I think this monk was just going past the Anagarika's block. He just happened to see through the window, and this man was fast asleep. And so he wasn't meditating. And so when I actually interviewed him and took it seriously, it turned out that, you know, he was a homeless boy, and he just survived in life, you know, just by being such an excellent, please excuse me, but a liar. He could deceive so many people. You know, he'd read the book, you know, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, memorized it, amazingly so, and could actually repeat it almost word for word, you know, and was convincing one of the senior monks that what was said in there is what he was experiencing. It was really quite sort of amazing that he could do something like that. And, of course, you know, lying about such things meant that, you know, he couldn't stay in Bodhinyana Monastery. And, you know, he said that just... You know, how he survived in life was, you know, just by telling people what they wanted to hear. And my goodness, he was so good at that. But he came there and learning the teachings, just learning the teachings, reciting them, is never enough. Sooner or later, you know, you got to be those teachings, you know, to live them, to have them so inside of you that it's not just a theory you're learning to repeat to others. It's what you understand yourself. So for this particular case, even in India at the time, this monk called Wanderer Susima became a monk just because he wanted to find out what's really going on, find his teachings, take them back to his friends, and then they could also get lots of support. So at that time... yeah, please, yeah. Yeah, and they never did, yes, and also, exactly, And it might have been, sometimes people say, well, didn't the Buddha suss out, understand that this monk or this person was actually just coming in just to try and for the wrong purposes? That's in some of the footnotes there. And there's no explanation there at all, but what they usually say is, no, the Buddha knew what was happening, because it's really important for this series of events to happen, to actually to allow a teaching to come down to us. So this seems a little bit sort of unconvincing, but nevertheless, it's a very good point. The Buddha allowed him to go forth without even mentioning a time of probation. Because usually if you come from another tradition, usually you... because this was true in Wat Phapong. A monk came along, he said he was a Catholic before, he was a Catholic priest. And he'd got ordained, I think, in another place. But as he was meditating in Wat Phapong, one of the monks went past and found there was a bottle of wine in his hut. And he said, well, you know, it's not for indulgence, but because he's still a Catholic, he has to do the Mass for himself. And you can actually see, well, you know, if you're a Catholic priest, fine. But if you're a Buddhist monk, you've got to be a Buddhist monk. You know, the two there sometimes just don't meet. He's had his robes on and everything. So anyway, that's why sometimes it's good to have a period of probation so that you can learn the basics of what's required, what's expected of a Buddhist monk. And then, if you like it, you know, to be ordained. Anyway, there we go. So at that time, several monks and nuns had declared their enlightenment in the Buddha's presence. In other words, they would come up to the Buddha and describe their experiences and their attainments. They would not usually say those attainments to others, unless they were monks, because there are some very serious penalties. If any monk or nun comes and says they've got some of these attainments, they're enlightened or a stream winner or jhanas or stuff like that, and they're just boasting, they know they haven't got those states, but they're, oh, well, you know, I'm as good as they are, out of pride, then that's such a serious offence that you cannot continue life as a monk or a nun. It's a disrobable offence. It's very serious. So usually, and even if it's true, and you say that to a lay person, that's also a pajitya offence. In other words, very clear the Buddha wanted the monks and nuns, any attainment which you have, to actually, you can tell your teacher, maybe tell a couple of fellow monks or fellow nuns, but don't take it further than that. So you keep it quiet. And it's usually the case that monks or nuns who do go around telling that they're this or that, they're not keeping the Vinaya. And that's usually a very clear case that they cannot be enlightened. So anyway, several monks and nuns had declared their enlightenment in the Buddha's presence. And they said that we understand rebirth is ended, the spiritual journey has been completed, what had to be done has been done. There is no return to any state of existence. It's a claim of enlightenment. And Venerable Susima heard about this. He went up to those monks and exchanged greetings with them. When the greetings and polite conversations were over, he sat down to one side and said to those monks, "Is it really true that the Venerables have declared enlightenment in the Buddha's presence?" "Yes, Reverend," you can say that to another monk. "But knowing and seeing thus, being enlightened, do you wield the many kinds of psychic power? That is, multiplying yourself and becoming one again, going unimpeded through a wall, a rampart, or a mountain as if through space. Diving in and out of the earth as if it were water, walking on water as if it were earth, flying cross-legged through the sky like a bird, Do you visit the heaven of Brahma? No, Reverend? Well, it's a bit disappointing. You're enlightened, you can't do any of those tricks. Well, knowing and seeing thus, can you, with clear audience, this is purified and superhuman, hear both kinds of both kinds of sounds, human and divine, whether near or far? No, Reverend. Well, knowing and seeing thus, can you read the minds of others? Do you know that their mind is poisoned with wanting, aversion, delusion or not? Do you know that their mind is contracted with sloth and torpor or not? Or that their mind is scattered with restlessness and remorse or not? Do you know that their mind is in jhana, exalted, surpassed, deliberated or not? And they said, well, we knew you were going to say that. No, that's not true. They said, no, Reverend. They did know. Well, knowing and seeing thus, can you recollect your past lives, even up to 100,000 births? Can you remember, there I was so named, of such a family, I looked like this, and that was my food. This was how I felt pleasure and pain, and that was how my life ended. When I passed away from that place, I was reborn somewhere else. There too I was so named, this, of such a family, I looked like this, and this was my food. This was how I felt pleasure and pain, and that was how my life ended. When I passed away from that place, I was reborn here. Can you recollect your many kinds of past lives with features and details? No, Reverend, they answered. Well, knowing and seeing us, do you with clairvoyance that is purified and superhuman see sentient beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, beautiful and ugly, in a good place or a bad place, and understand how sentient beings are reborn according to their karma? No, Reverend. Well, knowing and seeing thus, do you have direct meditative experience of the immaterial attainments? And those are the mind base of unlimited space, the mind base of unfathomable consciousness, the mind base of nothingness, the mind base of neither perception nor non-perception. No, Reverend. Well, now, Venerables, how could there be such a declaration of enlightenment when these things are not attained? Reverend Susima, we are freed by wisdom. Upanya Vimuti. I don't understand the meaning of what you have said. Please elaborate so I may understand the meaning. Reverend Susima, whether you understand or not, we are freed by wisdom. Now, at this particular time, I have translated it very clearly, accurately, with a couple of pitching errors, unfathomable spelling errors, sorry. But where they usually assume that it's an attainment without the jhanas, all it actually says here is that, well, knowing and seeing that, you have direct meditative experience of the immaterial attainments. And they say no. And this is usually the difference between someone who is both ways liberated or just liberated through wisdom. There's a quote which comes later on in this afternoon's presentation. Unfortunately, it's only in the Pali, but it shows the difference between liberated both ways and liberated on one side only. Both of them include having experience of the four jhanas. The difference is whether they have the experience of the immaterial attainments. And even if they have attainment of the immaterial attainments, it doesn't always mean that they get the psychic powers as well. So just because it says, that doesn't say they're liberated through wisdom, and it says nothing about the jhanas, doesn't mean the liberation of wisdom occurs without the jhanas. Maybe just, it's not the best here, but can you just scroll down to the bottom? It's in the Pali. You've got that, the last part. I think you can number 44 and 45 of Anguttara 9, okay. Panya Vimuti, Panya Vimuti. That's liberated through wisdom, panya. How is that Kitabhata? What does that mean? Panya Vimuti and Bhagavad to the Buddha. And it said, first of all, Vivicheva Karmehi Patamang Jhanam Upasampaja Viharati. That's the first jhana. And then you understand that with wisdom. The second jhana, the third jhana. And for the Panya Vimuti, they at least have the jhanas. For those who are scholars, maybe listening in, or those who are here, where it says in the end, what is called the four immaterial attainments, which they have afterwards, in the Pali text version, suttas, in the Pali, the one wonderful thing about the Pali text society is they do not just base their translation on one manuscript, but they compare many manuscripts, or whatever they can find. And they list here that under the Panya Vimuti Sutta, the explanation of liberation through wisdom, they say many of the manuscripts which they have, they do omit. They don't have the immaterial attainments under the Panya Vimuti, the one who's liberated by wisdom, which is far more consistent with what is being said in the Susima Sutta and also in many other suttas. Sometimes even the manuscripts which we have over many years have been copied, and especially copied not very carefully, and some manuscripts do not have for a Panya Vimuti that is liberated by wisdom any mention of the immaterial attainments, but they do have always the four jhanas. And the Ubhatobhaga Vimuti, that is someone who is liberated both ways, and liberated both ways, you can see there, even though you don't know Pali, Patamang Jhanang, Dutiya Jhanang, and all of those are there, and they certainly all the manuscripts do have the immaterial attainments as well. So I just put that down for any scholars to reinforce the idea, liberated both ways means with the jhanas and the immaterial attainments. Liberated on just with wisdom on one side is with the jhanas, but not with the immaterial attainments. Any questions or comments on that? Have I confused you all? Yeah. Liberated just on the basis of those four jhanas. They never went as far as the immaterial attainments. And it does seem, even from this sutta, well, it's not actually that true, that if you have immaterial attainments, and if you have, you're more likely to have some of the psychic powers. But that's not always the case. Even with jhanas, some people get psychic powers. And even if you have psychic powers, does that mean you've got enlightenment? Please mention one famous individual who had psychic powers and was certainly not enlightened. Thank you very much, you all pass. Devadatta, he was a Buddha's cousin. And he could, he got really famous that he... He always getting a bit sort of jealous of his cousin, the Buddha. And once he got some nice psychic powers, he appeared on the king's lap as a snake. Just imagine you're sitting there and this big snake appeared. And then he turned into Devadatta. And of course, you know, the king was very impressed with that. So those are the sort, and so sent him lots and lots of gifts. So, and of course, later on, that Devadatta became... too proud and even tried to kill the Buddha, to assassinate him. And the same with that monk I was mentioning in Wappapong, the monk which I knew only very briefly because he was just there when I first went there, who did develop the power of clairaudience, who could hear what people were saying 5-6 kilometres away. You know, tested out, it was true, and he got so proud that he thought he was even better than Ajahn Chah and sat in his seat one day. And Ajahn Chah was very skilled in these matters, took him aside, and the next day this monk sort of realized he'd gone too far and bowed to all of the monks, even though he was really senior, and even to me. I was only just I don't think I was really accepted into the Sangha there yet, just the first time coming up there to visit. And everyone he bowed to, asked forgiveness, and then disappeared. He just went away, quietly living by himself somewhere. And it was a fascinating thing to witness. There was someone who really did have a psychic power, but because it was a great thing to be able to do, then decided that was that he was superior than other people. Similar to Devadatta, but Devadatta was far worse. So, just because you've got psychic powers does not mean you're enlightened. Just because you're enlightened doesn't mean you have psychic powers. So anyway, here we go. So, Sushima went to see the Buddha, bowed, sat down to one side, and informed the Buddha of all he had discussed with those monks. And the Buddha replied to him, "Sushima, first comes the deep insight into the immutability of natural law, the Dhamma. Then comes the deep realization of Nibbana." So I don't understand the meaning of what you have said. Please elaborate the meaning. Reverend Sushima, whether you understand or not, first comes the deep insight into the immutability of natural law. Then comes the deep realization of Nibbana. So in other words, when you understand how things work, you understand where things come from, you understand the nature of the Dhamma, you understand that whether whoever you are, that cause and effect, the way the world works, the way the mind works, is immutable, whether you believe in it or you don't believe in it, whether you're enlightened or you're not enlightened, whoever you are, wherever you are, this immutable law of the Dhamma always holds. And that's, he said, that's what you understand first of all. Once you understand the situation, how things work, then you understand sort of Nibbana. It's just like if you understand you have a problem in the car and you can't understand why it's not working properly, you understand the immutable fact that the car needs petrol and you haven't put anything in, then you understand why your car's not working. Or the other simile about that man, I think the nuns know this because they thought it was very funny the last time I told it, the man who went to see the doctor and said, "What's wrong with you? My whole body hurts." "What do you mean your whole body hurts?" "When I touch my head, it hurts. You know, when I touch my throat, it hurts. When I touch my arm, it hurts. When I touch my tummy, it hurts. When I touch my knee, it hurts. It hurts all over." And the doctor said, "That's because you've got a broken finger." "Oh, you thought it was funny too. Wonderful. Thank you." So when you understand that it hurts because you've been born, this is what the world is, the immutability, and once you understand the problem is, then the experience, realization of Nibbana should happen afterwards. It doesn't matter how long it takes, but it will happen. You understand the mess you're in a prison, and the door's open, and of course, if you really understand that, you'll get out. So, that's just my little explanation for you. So, what do you think, Sushima? Does the body persist, or does it disintegrate? You just have to look around to see many of you are disintegrating. Some are even more advanced in your decrepitude than others. Getting faster and faster. And it said, disintegrates, Venerable Sir. Now, you can see the change in little translation. Instead of permanent, I'm impermanent. You know, that's a bit too philosophical. Let's get it down to, is it persist or disintegrate? You can see disintegration is a much better word for impermanent there. It disintegrates, Venerable Sir. It's what disintegrates, suffering or happiness? That's a pretty obvious answer. Suffering, Venerable Sir. Is what disintegrates is suffering and subject to change, fit to be guarded thus. This is mine, this I am, this is a permanent essence. If this body was your permanent essence, you'll be in bigger trouble than you know. You're going to carry on like this and get worse and worse. Oh my goodness. So it can't be a permanent essence of soul. It can't belong to you. If it did belong to you, then you'd be able to do something about it. So, no, Venerable Sir. Does experience, Vedana, persist or disappear? Does perception persist or disappear? Does will stay the same or come and go and alter? That's Sankara. Are consciousnesses constant or changing? Always changing, Venerable Sir. Is what is always changing, suffering or happiness? Suffering, Venerable Sir. Why? It's because you're having a really good time and then it stops. And it's totally out of control. Sometimes you have a beautiful afternoon. Things are wonderful. It's sunny and the birds are singing. And you're listening to a nice sutta class. And everything is wonderful and happy. And then you go outside and I don't know what's happened. Something's gone wrong. So consciousnesses and their content are always changing. So because they're changing, suffering or happiness, suffering. Is what is in constant suffering and subject to change fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is the permanent essence, no Venerable Sir. So, Susima, you should truly see any kind of form at all, past, future or present, internal or external, coarse or fine, inferior or superior, far or near, all form, all bodies, all stuff, with right understanding. This is not mine. I am not this. This cannot be a permanent essence. You should truly see any kind of feeling at all, past, future or present, internal or external, coarse or fine, inferior or superior, far or near. This is all experience I should put there. With right understanding. This is not mine. I am not this. This cannot be a permanent essence. We should see, truly see any kind of perception at all, past, future or present, internal or external, coarse or fine, inferior or superior, far or near, all perception with right understanding. This is not mine, I am not this, this cannot be a permanent essence. You should truly see any kind of will at all, past, future or present, and what you did in the past, was it you? Was it your deeds? Are you responsible? Any kind of will in the past, future or present, internal or external, coarse or fine, inferior or superior, far or near, all will with right understanding. This is not mine, I am not this, this cannot be a permanent essence. You should truly see any kind of consciousness at all, past, future or present, internal or external, coarse or fine, inferior or superior, original consciousness or universal consciousness. I put that in there. It didn't say that in there, but I justify that by saying the Buddha said all types of consciousness. So I can put that in as well. Far or near, all consciousnesses with right understanding. This is not mine. I am not this. This cannot be a permanent essence. Seeing this, these are the five components of existence. They're not mine, they're not me, not a permanent essence, suffering, you can't depend upon them. Seeing this, a learned, noble disciple experiences revulsion towards material stuff. Revulsion means that, not negativity, you think, just what am I doing this? Is there a way out? Why don't I take the escape? Revulsion towards material stuff. Revulsion towards experience, revulsion towards perception, revulsion towards will, revulsion towards consciousnesses. Remember that revulsion, the word is nibbida, it is what I kept on calling the eject a seat from the wheel of samsara. Experience revulsion, the five components of existence fade away. Fading away, there is freedom. When freed, the knowledge arises that it is freed. They understand rebirth is ended. The spiritual journey has been completed. What had to be done has been done. There is no return to any state of existence. So, that's standard teaching of non-self and suffering and impermanence. So then, having taught that, this is the immutable Dhamma. Do you see that rebirth is the cause for old age and death? Now you get reborn again. Doesn't matter where you get reborn. You can get old and die. Yes, sir. Do you see that existence is the cause for rebirth? And these are called the planes of existence. This word is bhava. It's a very difficult word, often mistranslated as becoming. It's not becoming. It's not that particular tense. It's being. They have places like manasabhava, the existence in the human realm, the animal bhava, the plane of existence of animals. So this is like planes of existence, places where you can get reborn into. This is planes of existence. Yes, sir. Do you see that fuel, tasting things up, that's literal meaning of upadana. Upa means the same in English as upa, and adana, to take up. That taking things up is a cause for creating states of existence. Yes, sir. Do you see that craving is a cause for taking things up? Yes, sir. Do you see that experience is a cause for craving? Contact is a cause for experience. The six sense fields are the cause for contact. Name and form are cause for six sense fields. And consciousness are a cause for name and form. Will is a cause for consciousness and delusion is a cause for will. That's standard dependent origination. From ignorance, delusion, we prefer it. That is where will comes from. The will, the sense of a self. So you've got to do something. You've got to struggle. The main avijja is the sense of I am, or this is me, and I can find some happiness if I strive. And because of the will, you strengthen the consciousnesses. And with the consciousnesses, you need the name and the form, the objects of consciousness, and the six sense bases. Often I wonder, what are especially the five senses doing there? And the five senses are constructed for your will to explore this sense world with the thought that somewhere in the sense world you can find some happiness, some satisfaction, and some sense of fulfillment. One of the greatest of those similes I remember from elsewhere is that just like you throw a dog a bone, which is smeared with some blood, and so the dog, expecting it can get some satisfaction from the bone, will actually taste the food, got a little bit of blood on it, taste it, but can't get any further than the taste. Still as hungry as it was afterwards. And they said that's a simile for the sense pleasures. It promises fulfillment, but never satisfies. Never fulfills. So from delusion comes the will, and the will causes the consciousness, and the consciousness, together with the will, create the sense fields, the sense experience, and with the experience is always the thing about picking things up, taking things up. This is one of those similes elsewhere, which I thought was an original Ajahn Brahm, when I found that the Buddha got there much earlier than I did. It was a bit spooky because I'm sure I never read that in this life. I said, like taking things up, why is it you can probably be watching me? I take things up, I put that down, and I take something else up. You fiddle with this and you fiddle with that. You ever notice that when you have a hand, it's always fiddling with something, always taking things up? Because that's the purpose of having a hand. You pick things up. I challenge you not to pick anything up for one day. You can't do that. because that's the nature of a hand, that's what it does. So I thought, how can you stop picking things up with the hand? There's only one way, cut the hand off. Now this is only a metaphor, I'm not going to do this, but if you did take the hand off, of course you won't be able to pick things up. So what's the only way to stop picking things up, upadana, is actually to cut off the thing which picks things up. And that is the sense of self. That's what the sense of I does. It always picks things up and does stuff. So that's how only time that upadana will stop is when the sense of I and self disappear. And I thought, wow, what an original simile that was. Until you saw the simile of the hand taught by the Buddha so much earlier than I did. That was both interesting, because I never read that before. Interesting, but also freaky. Anyway, so that's how you stop. But when you start picking things up, because of craving, because of the thirst, that's another meaning for craving. Then from the craving, you actually create planes of existence. And that's where you get reborn afterwards. We fantasize, we dream of where we want to be. You create that world. And very often that's where you get reborn. And when you get reborn, then you have the old age and death. Wheel goes round. So anyway, that's just basic dependent origination. And also with dependent origination, dependent cessation. That when rebirth ceases, you don't have any more rebirth, of course old age and death ceases. Yeah. See, when planes of existence cease, you stop making planes of existence, then you've got no place to get reborn into. There's no rebirth. Yes, sir. Do you see that when taking things up, upadana, the fuel, causes states of existence? So when taking things up ceases, states of existence cease. When craving ceases, taking things up cease. When the experience ceases, the craving ceases. You don't want anything. When contact ceases, experience ceases, sixth sense will cease, contact ceases. Six senses, not just the five senses, it's the mind as well, cease. Contact ceases when the name and form, the objects of the consciousnesses cease. So, sixth sense will cease. When consciousness ceases, the objects of consciousness cease. When the will ceases, consciousness ceases. When delusion ceases, will ceases. Yes, sir. But knowing and seeing thus, do you wield the many kinds of psychic power, Susima? No, sir. Well, knowing and seeing thus, do you, with clear audience that is purified and superhuman, hear both kinds of sound, human and divine, whether near or far? No, sir. Well, knowing and seeing thus, do you understand the minds of other beings and individuals, having comprehended them with your mind? No. Knowing and seeing thus, do you recollect many kinds of past lives with features and details? No, sir. Well, knowing and seeing thus, do you, with clairvoyance that is purified and superhuman, see sentient beings passing away and being reborn according to their karma? No. Well, knowing and seeing thus, do you have direct meditative experience of the mere material attainments? No, sir. Well, now, Susima, how could there be such a declaration when these things are not attained? So you understand some of the ways of the Dhamma, the basic principles of the Dhamma, or at least accepting them, that the enlightenment is far greater. And he hasn't got any psychic powers, obviously. So, how could there be such a declaration when these things are not attained? Then Venerable Susima bowed with his head at the Buddha's feet and said, I have made a mistake, sir. It was foolish, stupid, and unskillful of me to go forth as a thief in such a well-explained teaching and training. Please, sir, accept my mistake for what it is, so I will restrain myself in future. Indeed, Susima, you made a mistake. It was foolish, stupid, and unskillful of you to go forth as a thief in such a well-explained teaching and training. Suppose I were to arrest a bandit, a criminal, and present him to the king, saying, Your Majesty, this is a bandit, a criminal. Punish him as you will. And the king would say, Go, my men, and tie this man's arms tightly behind his back with a strong rope. shave his head. I don't know why they always just shave people's head as a matter of punishment. It didn't happen to you, did it? No. But in those days, shaving a person's head was like a punishment. And marching from street to street and from square to square to the beating of a harsh drum. Then take him out of the south gate and there to the south of the city, chop off his head. The king's men would do as they were told. What do you think, Susima? Wouldn't that man experience pain and distress because of that? Yes, sir. But although that man would experience pain and distress because of that, going forth as a thief in such a well-explained teaching and training has a more painful and bitter result. It even leads to the underworld. So, just saying, it's a bad thing he did. But, what happens next? But since you have recognized your mistake for what it is, and have dealt with it properly, I accept it. For it is growth in the training of the noble one to acknowledge a mistake for what it is, deal with it properly, and commit to restraint in the future. The old acknowledge, forgive, and learn. So you acknowledge the mistake for what it is. Deal with it properly, commit to restraint in the future. Deal with it properly, you know, forgive it, don't punish yourself. Commit to restraint in the future, learn from it. So when I do acknowledge, forgive, learn, it's not just invented by myself. That is just what, one of the things which really impressed me with the teaching of the Buddha, that no punishment. Yeah, you could be punished, but as long as you acknowledge it, then this is where the growth happens. So there was, I mentioned that teaching because sometimes people say, oh, that just teaches that you don't need the jhanas to become liberated through wisdom. And of course it never says that at all. It says that you're not experiencing the immaterial attainments. But this was, comes afterwards. It certainly is liberated. The Fumpanya Vimutta and Ubhata Vimutta, you are liberated through wisdom. You still have to have the jhanas. There was one piece of advice which I've repeated many times here and was very fortunate to get from the mouth of Venerable Jnanaponika. Venerable Jnanaponika was a great German-born monk who did a lot of translations. Oh, where's the other book I have here? Just in case people want to, the Kitagiri said, this Discourse of the Buddha, oh, this was Jnanamoli, sorry. Jnanaponika did many, many translations. And many of his translations, you know, were wonderful to read, very accurate. But when I was visiting him, we were discussing with Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, and Jnanaramata, and who else was there? Oh, there was one Battersby. He was there. And that's Bianca's partner. And one thing he said there in a discussion always stayed with me, where he said that you should never, when you are learning the word of the Buddha, the suttas, never interpret an ambiguous part of the Buddha's teachings. So never interpret the whole of the Buddha's teachings, a clear part of the Buddha's teachings, in accordance with an ambiguous part of the Buddha's teachings, but always interpret the ambiguous part in line with all the very clear teachings of the Buddha, which are in the majority. And of course you all know, sutta after sutta, the way to enlightenment, Eightfold Path, Eightfold Path, Eightfold Path, which does always include the four jhanas. So not only should a red flag come up for people who think, oh, Susima Sutta, Kitagiri Sutta, is saying that you can become enlightened without the jhanas, that would be contradictory to what's said elsewhere in the suttas. And also, today hopefully, when I've read this sutta out, pointing out was where sometimes people look at this and they say, well, knowing and seeing that you have direct meditative experience of the immaterial attainments, they say the peaceful attainments which are without any form, if you don't translate that accurately, people feel that that means the jhanas. It does not. It only means the immaterial attainments, which is how I've translated it here. So that means you do have to do the jhanas. And it's also just saying something about the usual teachings of the Buddha, that these things, the five components of existence, the fact that analyzing them means they are impermanent, unreliable, cannot be regarded as a source of happiness, therefore cannot be a permanent self, and that the dependent origination, how we do we get reborn, that these are immutable dharmas, whether Buddha arises or not, person understands or not. So understand those first of all, and from those immutable dharma, eventually then enlightenment will happen. Any comments, questions, complaints? Yeah. Okay, yeah.
We know the Buddha is perfectly enlightened. Does that imply you can be imperfectly enlightened?
Yeah. When they say perfectly enlightened, that's usually the term for Sama Sambuddha, which means that they always say enlightened by himself without a teacher. So there is, when you say perfectly, sometimes perfectly self-enlightened, but the self doesn't have really a place in there. And that starts to lead to a controversy, which was even part of the Melinda Panha, the points of controversy, which was certainly, it belongs to the Abhidharma, that's where it's part of the Tripitaka, but that was obviously, very clearly, many hundreds, 150 years or so, some people differ in their timing, after the Parinibbana of a Buddha. But there, they said that some people say that when the Buddha arrived in this world as Siddhartha Gautama, that he was a once-returner, a Sakadagami. He was born as a Sakadagami. And was one of the reasons why, when he did his seven steps and said, this is my last life, that there was a reason for that, because he was a Sakadagami. And that one of the things which convinced me that that argument has some merit was the Gatikara Sutta. In the Gatikara Sutta, in the Majjhima Nikaya, there, the Buddha recalled a previous life as, I always get it wrong, Jyotipala or Jyotipana? Jyotipala, thank you. Jyotipala. And Jyotipala was Gatikara was a close disciple of Kassapa Buddha. So this was the Buddha recording a previous life. And he said this Jyotipala was Gatikara's friend. Jyotipala didn't want to have anything at all to do with religion, and even called Kassapa the Buddha, who was his best friend's teacher, he called Kassapa the Buddha a shaving-headed good-for-nothing, basically. And Gatikara, his best friend, was a very good disciple of Kassapa the Buddha, even an anagami, a non-returner, and was trying everything to get his best friend to see Kassapa the Buddha, eventually tricked his best friend Jyotipala to see Kassapa the Buddha, at which point Jyotipala was inspired and became a monk with Kassapa the Buddha. And the story Gatikara Sutta goes on to what happened to Gatikara next. And Jyotipala is not really mentioned except at the very end of the sutta, where our current Buddha said, I was Jyotipala in a previous life. The Buddha is saying that he was a monk, a bhikkhu, under Kassapa the Buddha. So unless one just says, oh, that's just made up, But there is another sutta which reaffirms that connection. So it's not just in one place in the suttas. In the Devaputta Samyutta, it was the Gatikara, now a heavenly being, in the Sudawasa, which is where Anagamis get reborn. Gatikara was one of the heavenly beings who came to visit the Buddha at Bodh Gaya under the Bodhi tree just after the Buddha's enlightenment. And there Gatikara, now a Deva, said, "Congratulations, you know, you're now a Buddha. I was up in the Sudawasa where Anagamis go. We were together in our previous life as under Kassapa the Buddha." Two old friends congratulating one another. Or rather, Gatikara doing most of the congratulations because he was a Buddha. But old friends, now one a Buddha, now another, just still in the Sudawasa, as a non-returner. And when, if you can accept that, and there's no reason why not, Gotama the Buddha, our Buddha, has had a previous life under Kassapa the Buddha. And you would have thought, would have learned something under Kassapa the Buddha. Where did, there's another sutta which says that if a person does attain to being a once returner are most reborn in the Tusita realm. And of course we all know that that's where the Buddha came from before his birth in Lumbini. So, joining the dots is a very strong case that the Buddha was a disciple under Kassapa the Buddha and would have learned the Dhamma there. And under the Bodhi tree, first watch of the night, remembered his previous lives. So of course he remembered his previous lives. That was a very close one. Surely he would have remembered a powerful life under a previous Buddha. He remembered the Dhamma. So was the Buddha really self-taught? Or did he get those teachings from a previous life under Kassapa, the Buddha? I would actually probably say the evidence is quite strong that he did. Anyway, you had a question.
Ajahn Brahm, if the Buddha is a once returner, why does he still have sexual desire? Like, why did he still
Because once returners still have sexual desire. There's one very famous one. The, not Sarakani, Isidatta and Purana, wasn't it? Isidatta and Purana, they were brothers or cousins. They were related together. And when they passed away, Buddha said, oh, they were both once returners. I said, how can they be? I think one of them was married, was well known, enjoying his sensual pleasures. The other one was keeping 8 precepts. And the Buddha said, yeah, one of those Isidatta Purana, one of them had still strong sensual attachment, but enormous wisdom. It was incredibly strong in wisdom. And he said the other one was really restrained, but not as much wisdom. But the two of them together, they were once returner.
Ajahn, if the Buddha was a non-returner,
yeah,
then the Brahma, the Gatikara, would have said we were mates in the Sudavasa, but he said we were together in the...
In the previous life, no. Once returners don't go to Sudavasa, non-returners go to Sudavasa.
Oh, sorry, non-returner?
Yes.
So then he would have said...
He's a once returner.
Once returner.
Once returner, yes, sorry.
Once returner.
I didn't pronounce it.
Okay.
Thank you. Returner.
And on this one, Ajahn, that the sutta, this what you just now taught.
Susima, yeah?
Yes, Susima Sutta. The expressly what is mentioned is that immaterial jhana is not required, So is there an inference here then that the, what you are saying is inferred that this is arupavachara, isn't it? Jhana, material jhana. So material jhana, that is the four jhanas are called material jhanas?
It is called material, it's called rupa.
Rupa
jhana.
Rupa jhana.
It's a difficult word to explain because it is certain that in the those four jhanas, that I think it's actually rupa jhana, it's not usually called rupa jhanas, except in a few commentaries, Abhidharma. It's usually called just the four jhanas, but the afterwards is called arupa.
Arupa.
So the jhanas are just jhanas. Patama jhana, if you look even down,
yes,
the last page 456 of this, you can see just descriptions. Patamam jhana upa sampajali. You don't usually use the word rupa in front of the jhanas. But what it does do is that when you make the transition from the fourth jhana to the immaterial, then it's like going beyond all rupa.
Exactly what you are saying, what I think, what I am asking you is that it is expressly it is mentioned that arupa jhanas, that these monks who attain enlightenment, they didn't have arupa jhana, but the inference is that they had to have the four jhanas.
Yes, all this sutta says is they didn't have the immaterial arupa attainments. So that's the what it said specifically there. But it doesn't mean they don't have the four jhanas. And I mentioned the very wise words of Venerable Jnanaponika, the German translator, that he said that you have to make the inferences based on the other large number, massive number of teachings of the Buddha, which says that the jhanas are necessary. There's no enlightenment without them. And that's part of the Eightfold Path. So you can't knock off one of the factors of an Eightfold Path thinking that thereby that one can find an easier way.
Inferred, but not stated specifically here. That the four jhanas,
it's not stated specifically, so one cannot make that inference that this sutta means you can get enlightenment without a jhana. It doesn't say that. Yeah.
We've been learning the Noble Eightfold Path, that's the complete path and the only path. And obviously that ends up with Samma Samadhi.
Mm-hmm.
But am I right to say that the first completion of this path leading to Samma Samadhi is probably not enough? In a sense that I think many monks accept that other sects, other ascetics, other sadhu can have jhana. But I think they are quite far from enlightenment. They don't even have their view fixed.
Yeah.
They think of the big self. But still they seem to have great samadhi.
Yep. So you need all factors of the Eightfold Path. Not just number 8. Not just number 7, the right mindfulness. You need also the right view as well.
But I thought without some measure of right view, one cannot access samadhi properly?
You know, it seems like without some measure, but not sort of a full measure of right view. And a good example of that, I was talking about that to someone earlier, that even looking at examples of medieval 13th century Christian saints, Teresa of Avila, St. John of the Cross, those two in particular, their translations are just, I don't know if they're really trustworthy, but it does seem there may be a case there that those two did experience some level of jhana. And then I asked myself, well, how can they, coming from such a background of belief in a supreme being, And of course the answer comes that as you are meditating, there has to be a lot of letting go. And you know, for a Buddhist to let go, you know, it's a very scary thing. Actually, to let go of control of your body, to stop willing, to stop doing something. But for a very, very devout Christian immersed in the belief of an all-powerful, omniscient, loving God, it could be quite simple in a sense to actually to let go. I'm going to totally let go of control. I'm going to disappear and let the Supreme Being take over. Just be still and know that thou art God, which is again in Psalms in the Christian Bible. To be able to do that, take such a letting go, and be wonderful if some Supreme Being, I trust in the Supreme, you take over, it makes it a little bit easier to let go. And I think that's probably because St. Teresa of Avila, one thing was pretty clear, was, you know, she would levitate. And she'd get into her bliss states. As recorded, some of the other nuns, I don't know if this happens over in Dharamsala when you're doing the chanting, but they'd start floating up and they had to grab hold of her pretty quickly. And one of the monks told them some other saint, and sometimes he would start floating off, and just he'd get sort of caught in the branches of a tree or something, you know, and that's where it's like a balloon floating off, you know, gets caught in the tree branches, and that's where they had to go and climb and get him down. Interesting stuff from those days. But it seems to be, I'm not sure, those people, 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th century, and then it seems to have died out after that. Those levitations and those deep states of samadhi.
Yeah, because I know maybe more recently, like the Maharishi.
Maharishi.
He seems to have very impressive samadhi, but yeah. His teachings are way off the mark.
Yeah, if so you can have that like Devadatta. So it can, you can have that, you can, you know, get into deep states of samadhi, but not through willpower. It has to be some sort of letting go, and a letting go into a supreme being, a god, a Brahma or whatever, going to a union with God. That is one possibility, but that's without the wisdom.
Whereas on the other hand, I read based on my reading of the suttas, yeah. that there are even lay people, I mean, who even yeah. tried to kill the Buddha, obviously no jhana, but they said, the Buddha said he was on the path.
Yeah, yeah.
He was said he was on track.
Yeah, yeah, on the track.
No,
yeah.
He was on track, and to me that's more impressive than other sects.
Exactly, you know, yes.
The ascetics or whatever with great meditative attainment.
Yeah, indeed. But the thing is, how do you know you're on the path? This is one of the problems, that how do you know you have the right teacher or not? And that was the simile, you have to get similes of being able to see the simile of the being lost in the mist in the Scottish Highlands. When you go so far underneath the mist, then you can actually see your way, you find out where you are. Then you don't need to trust, you know, just following a stream downhill. You can get your bearings, you can see the path, you can see just where you are in the scheme of things. Otherwise, by trusting other people, you can very easily walk off a cliff, you know, in the mist. So that's why it is, again, it is difficult, but at least, you know, in the case of even Jyoti Pala, you know, he got inspiration from seeing a Buddha before, enough to get on the path, enough to become sort of a once-returner, and getting reborn in his life. Remember, if he was a once-returner, he still got married to Yasodhara, and he still sort of was enjoying the pleasures of the senses until he saw, you know, the old man, sick man, and dying man, and the holy man. So that sort of almost woke him up. And then afterwards, you know, finding, didn't know what he was doing, trying to find some liberation, but then remembering. Well, then, as a six-year-old, you know, fluking the jhanas under the rose apple tree. Not many six-year-olds can do that. I don't know if you're Your son Shanti ever did that.
I'll be very proud of that.
But the Siddhartha Gautama managed that. Something from his past life kicking in. Okay, what is the microphone?
In Christianity, there's a big emphasis on surrender. That's
just the
same way as saying letting go, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But if you're surrendering into nothing, it's a bit more scary.
Indeed.
Than if you're surrendering into an all-loving, powerful, in the bliss of a God, yeah. I get some questions from here. Yes, one from Peter. Hasn't yet. But no. For some people, it helped in a sense. There was this one lady who, when I told her in a meditation retreat, just to take her hands off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals, and she had that dream of going over the cliff. No, with me sitting next to her, and she put the brakes on. And said, "No, hands off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals." And so she went over the cliff. And as she was hurtling down to certain death, she saw at the bottom of the cliff that, you know, it was bent over a bit, and there was a road, and it had a very tight right-hand turn. And so we're hurtling, and the car just leveled itself at the bottom of the cliff. And then she went to grab the wheel to turn right, said, "Hands off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals, no brakes." And then the car automatically by itself made a perfect right turn and was just very safely going across along the road with no damage at all. So she said, "Well, I have a measure of faith in you. At least in my dreams, it worked." So I said, "Next time, do it when you're meditating."
Is right view. So
yeah.
If one had the right view of non-self, then it wouldn't be. It'd be less and less scary.
Yeah. If indeed, this is the point that the Eightfold Path. You know, first of all, it's, you know, all over the place—a bit of this and a bit of that. But the first factor which really gels and becomes perfected is the right view of a stream winner. So once you have the right view of a stream winner, you know, there's. You know, you're not in control, there's nothing here. Of course, then you have the, what I call the right motivations of letting go, kindness and gentleness. There's no sort of me and get out of my way, I'm meditating. There's no force, aggression, anger. There's beautiful kindness. It's not about me anymore. So, from the right view then, of course, and the right motivation, which is really pure, all the precepts. No, it's not about you. You know, you don't want anything. So all the precepts come up in perfection. And then from that, the right effort becomes the one of letting go. It's based on kindness, based on gentleness, based on renunciation, based on just making sure you're guarding your senses rather than indulging them. And then from that, you know, it's mindfulness. Having restrained the five hindrances, which is what those have already done, then you can actually practice the four satipatthanas. And it's only a matter of time before the mind gets very, very still and peaceful and enters into a jhana. So you know that there is a sequential part of the Eightfold Path once you're a stream winner. But before then, it's a bit of this and a bit of that. We've got some questions from overseas. As well as psychic powers, are there also healing powers? And of course there are healing powers, but sometimes you wonder, you heal somebody and they get sick again? The Buddha's healing powers is probably best illustrated by the story of Kisa Gotami, which I think many of you, I hope, will remember. Kisa Gotami, single mother, had lost her child. The only thing she had in life, I don't know what happened to her husband, but one child and it died. And she was so grief-stricken. She went from place to place and someone healed my child, eventually went to see the Buddha. The Buddha had a big reputation of being has psychic powers. And so asked the Buddha, please heal my kid, bring him back to life. And so that's where the Buddha said, well, what I need you to do is to go and get 3 sesame seeds, each from a different house in town. But they have to come from a house where no one has ever died. And so what Kisa Gotami did, she went into town, really sort of thinking that, yes, I'm going to get these sesame seeds, that's really cheap, and then I get 3, and then my kid will be cured. Went to the first house, you got a sesame seed? Yeah, I'll give you a sesame seed. But, anyone ever died in here? Oh, yes, yeah, someone's died in here. Next house, oh, I can't use it, thank you very much. Went to the next house, someone had died in there. Went to the next house, someone had died in there. And went to so many houses in the village, and every house someone had died. And then, of course, she realized the Buddha's skillful means. She realized that the death does not just visit her son, it visits everybody. And so she went back to see the Buddha, buried, did the funeral service for her son, and then became a Buddhist nun, a bhikkhuni. And became one of the great bhikkhunis, fully enlightened. So instead of healing her son, the Buddha healed her mind. All healings are temporary. They take away some pain. But after a while, what else happens? You get sick again. So healing powers, yeah, okay. But is that really the purpose? So psychically, yeah, there are healing powers. They do work. But they're not really the ones which, you know, people just focus on. How does one resist becoming arrogant once attains such psychic powers? To keep remembering, put them into the context of the Buddhist teachings. That, yeah, they're nice tricks. Or as once happened when the Buddha this is in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, if I get it correctly, that the Buddha went with the following of monks to the banks of the Ganges River, and there was one ascetic there, a wanderer, who said, no, I've practiced for about 30 or 40 years, and now I can walk over the Ganges by myself. And the Buddha said, what a waste of time that was. You can actually get a ferry for a couple of cents. It's pretty cheeky to say this poor little wanderer practiced all his life to walk on water. And what do you want to walk on water for? So the psychic powers in themselves. Now what are you doing them for? A lot of times if those psychic powers happen, they happen as, you know, the free gift in the cornflakes packet. Just the extra, which a lot of times it's best you don't show off. And how do psychic attainments come to be? What are the psychic powers? I mentioned some of those. How do they come to be? Is that sometimes that just the mind is far greater than the physical world. Remember that little story, said opening the door of your heart, what's the biggest thing in the world? It's, you know, one of my friend's daughters, 5-year-old at school, when the teacher asked what's the biggest thing in the world, one person said my daddy, another said an elephant, another said a mountain. My friend's daughter said, biggest thing in the world is my eye. What are you talking about? Well, my eye can see her daddy, can see a mountain and an elephant and so much more. If all of that could fit into my eye must be the biggest thing in the world. Nice piece of logic. And of course, in that book, I took it a little bit further. Your mind is the biggest thing. Your mind can see everything. Your eye can see and things you can just imagine. Your mind can hear, can smell, real and imaginary smells. Can taste, can feel real and imaginary pains, and it has its own area of knowledge. Everything you will ever experience or can ever experience, real or imaginary, can fit into your mind. So mind's the biggest thing in the world. Because the mind transcends this world, that's where you can understand how psychic powers can come from. The mind powers, far greater than the world, is part of the mind. So those things, they just happen sometimes. But usually, good monks just, and nuns just keep them quiet. Still remember, in Magnolia Street days, and I remember Lynn, you were there. I don't know, were you there at the time, this little kid, maybe 7 or 8 years of age, came sat right in front of Ajahn Chakravarti and said, "Well, how much?" We're talking about how much. How many inches or feet? What are you talking about? How many inches and feet can you levitate? Come on, I want to see you levitate. That's what the kid was interested in, how high Ajahn Jacko could levitate. You don't do such things. Not in public. And, of course, it causes problems, like it did with that monk. I think one of the monks gave me his name. Do you know his name? He just kept on levitating, getting caught in the tree branches. Say something like that. I think Adam Mudito, he knows more about that guy. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, so what? Just causes the problem for people. Or you get the monk, Dabba Malaputta, that he was the one who could make, it was actually quite a useful psychic power in those days, he could make his finger sort of light up. So, you know, it's the fire element. And so, you know, he's enlightened, he had nothing else, he wasn't a good teacher. But he said, "What can I do to be of use to the Sangha?" So he lived in Rajagaha. Those of you who've actually visited Rajagaha, it was just this circle of mountains and many places. There's a bamboo grove, there's a vulture's peak, there's the Isigiri, the gullet of the seers or the rishis. There's many little places in there where the monks would stay. And so some of these visiting monks, they would deliberately arrive late. Late at night. They did that on purpose so that Dabba Malaputta, he was the guest monk. So he had to assign them lodgings and say, "Oh, where do you want to stay?" "Oh, the furthest possible lodging." Because they wanted to see his magic finger. So he'd light his fingers. He didn't have any torches or any flashlights or any street lights. So he'd light his finger at a nice light and he would show them the way to wherever they wanted to go. And so he was so good at that. I mean, if there was one of those at Dharmasara, you know, who could show the light with the finger, of course, I'm going to go and see this. So deliberately, you know, check in late just to get taken to the furthest kuti with a magic lit finger. So at least that psychic power did have a use to it. You don't need to waste money on batteries and lights. So anyway, it's just the nature of the mind is stronger than the world. The psychic powers. And of course, every now and again, okay, as a monk, have you ever seen these things? And of course, you know, the answer is yes, but you don't usually tell people about them when it happens in other people. Reading minds is very common. Hearing things from long distance is not that common. Seeing remembering past lives is very common these days. So many of these things can be done. But you know, they want the real things, walking on water. So, much better to use a boat. Okay, so any other comments or questions? How they come about just by the power of your mind. That's one of the reasons why the Samadhi does give you that power. Remember when I was saying about the power of mindfulness, the stillness collects all the energy, like taking a magnifying glass and putting it outside under the sun, collecting all of it together, get some energy, can actually burn a piece of paper. It focuses energy, brings it all together. Ekagata, coming to a oneness of the mind. That type of thing, you can feel energy happening. Be very careful not to misuse it. Okay. Enough? Any questions? Can't think of one. Very good. So, could you read my mind? I'm going to finish off with this wonderful story about, apparently this happened in Thailand a long time ago, that there was a minister who was a big know-it-all, you know, and he was actually very kind, very good, very smart and very capable, but really upset other people, you know, always being right. So the other ministers, they decided to, now let's sort of set him up so he gets kicked out of the palace. So they all met together in secret and they said, how can we get rid of this person? He's so arrogant. This is maybe our plan. We will praise him in front of the king, His Majesty the King. Praise him so much. You're so wonderful. And the king is so lucky to have a minister like you. And keep on praising him and praising him. Yeah, yeah, he's so lucky to have somebody like me. Yeah, I'm so wise. And then when he's arrogant enough, when he's full of pride, that's when we will ask him, you're probably so wise you can read other people's minds. And if he said yes, then say, okay, prove it. Read our mind. And of course, how can you prove that what he says is true? If I say, I'm going to read your mind, Venerable Upeka, you can say, whatever, even if I do get it right, say, no, that was wrong. And who can prove what's right and what's wrong in somebody's mind? So, whatever they said, whatever he said they were thinking, they'd always say, no, you got it wrong. So, the next morning when the court was in meeting, they started praising this minister. Oh, he's so wise. Apparently this actually happened. So wise, so wonderful, so smart, you're so wonderful. You're so lucky, Your Majesty, to have a minister like this. And then when he was full of pride, yeah, yeah, that's right, you're so lucky to have someone like me in your court. And then they sort of thought it was the right time. So you're probably so wise you can read other people's minds. Said, oh yeah, I can read other people's minds. He'd taken the bait, fallen into the trap. So they said, well, please tell His Majesty what we're all thinking. And they resolved whatever he said they were thinking, even if he got it right, they would say, no, you're wrong. Just to put him in his place. Without any hesitation, this minister said, each one of you, I can read your minds, each one of you is thinking kind, loyal thoughts to His Majesty the King. Yeah, you're right. Better let him be right than have your head chopped off. So that was wisdom. So if you want to tell your parents that you can read their mind, what are you thinking? I'm thinking, how lucky I am to have a parent like you. So anyway, that's using wisdom. Okay, so I think we can finish off now. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, let's just do the bowing now.
Arahaṃ sammāsambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sangha namami.